Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Catherine Smithies, a medieval historian at the University of Melbourne in Australia, to talk about her new book, Introducing the Medieval Ass, out last year, 2020, with the University of Wales Press. Hi, Catherine, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Yana. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, it's wonderful to talk to you. How are you today? It's your evening, yes?
It is. It's 4 p.m. and I'm sat in my woolly jumper because it's the middle of winter and it's very cold here.
Well, I mean, Australia cold, right?
Yes.
Not quite Northern European cold,
no,
is
no.
It?
Quite right. It's not a Northern European winter, but it's our winter all the same. So it's about 5 degrees.
Oh, yeah, that's legit. That's cold. Yeah, meanwhile, I'm, like, you know, sitting in Amsterdam in a singlet, like, hoping that I will not sweat to death. Okay, so you're a medievalist, medievalist in that way, with this interest in vernacular French literature. And so I see work on family history, gender, some lepers, interestingly, which I think I'm going to pick up next. I'm suddenly interested in lepers. Okay. And then there's this shift to the ass. How did that come about?
So my primary focus is the old French fabliau, which were a series of very funny, quite rude stories that were written in the 13th century. And you're quite right that it's quite a leap. It seems quite a leap from these funny stories to the medieval ass or the medieval donkey. But it's quite straightforward, really, because I got to know of a group, a scholarly group called the International Reynard Society. And the main interest is obviously the Reynard the Fox stories, but they're interested in animals in medieval literature. And one of their original members was a fabliau scholar. And so the fabliau were sort of invited to join, if you like. And they've been going about 40 years and they have a conference every 2 years. And I got to know them and become a member of the group. And so every time I go, I have to present on an animal that appears in the fabliau. And there are a few donkeys. And so that's how it came about, really.
Makes perfect sense. And actually, I mean, it's clear, right? And it's one of the ways it's clear is from your source material, which is something else I'd like you to talk about. Like, what did you use for this book?
Well, the sources were quite difficult, interesting, eclectic.
All those things.
If I go back a step and you think about the historiography of the medieval ass, there isn't really a body of scholarship that's focused purely on the ass. It's always sort of an add-on, if you like. So finding sources was quite difficult because you have to find what other people have written and then go to the primary source material and then try and build a picture of the medieval ass in, you know, in medieval of the ass in medieval society. So that was quite a challenge. And what I found really was that my sources obviously informed the chapters. So there were some sources that looked at the ass in its natural world, so how it lived on farms, how it helped people in war, at markets, in like trade and commerce, as a pack animal. So there were some sources like that, but they're so few and far between, and they're so spread out across medieval Europe that you're picking little snippets from here, from there, and then trying to build a picture. So there were sources, obviously, that informed the natural world. Then I had all the religious sources, you know, obviously the Bible, hagiographies were, you know, stories of saints and their interaction with animals and obviously the ass. You've got the scholastic sources. So you can see how eclectic it is. And yeah, obviously you've read the book, how it's informed the chapters. You know, but you've got... All the time, you've got this the donkey's reputation as either a stubborn and slow beast or as a humble beast associated with Christ that just keeps cropping up all the time. And then, of course, there's probably more examples of the donkey in literature, literature that was written for entertainment, so fables, the Fabliau, poems, and those sorts of that sort of literature.
Sure. And I mean, you can see it because you organize the book into four thematic chapters, listeners: scientific, religious, scholastic, and literary. And it was very clear that the kind of material you found, you could group it quite naturally in these ways, right? It that clearly informs your decision. And your sources are so varied, you know. And I'm an historian myself. So when I was reading this and I was thinking about just the amount of time you must have spent sifting through, you know, and it's rewarding and wonderful and we all love what we do, right? But sometimes it would be really nice if I think about my colleagues who have indexes or sortable databases and I think like, wow, that's nice. That would be nice. So I could fully see that. And you do, but they're everywhere, you know, you see, and surprisingly consistently, which we'll get into, but they're just everywhere. These fables, obviously, but then, you know, it's William of Ockham and Abelard are talking about the ass as well. It's very cool. We'll get there. Just one more thing before we really get into the body of the book, is more on the historiography of this. I see it as part of medieval literature. I see that. I recently did an interview with Jamie Kreiner about her new book, Legions of Pigs in the Early Medieval West, which is a lovely book. And this, of which, like, these are kind of co-evocative. And it feels like there's, like, maybe a growing body of study on animals and, or agriculture. Is that appropriate?
I think so. When I was invited to write the book, it was another scholar from the Reynard Society, who's probably more focused on animals than I am, or was. And she approached me and said, would I be interested in writing a book on the ass, because she'd seen my paper a few years earlier. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, I think that would be, I think I could do that. I think there's enough material there. And she said, I'm going to pitch an idea to the University of Wales Press about a series on medieval animals. And she was successful. So I think you're right. I think there is a growing interest in animals in the medieval world, in animals in general, and that crosses sort of borders. There's interest in animals, you know, how we treat animals, how animals interact with us, how we domesticate them, and so on. I think, you know, not just within the medieval world, but just in general. So, yes, I think she chose her time well, and the University of Wales Press was open to this. And from what I can gather, the series is proving to be quite successful. There are other books in the pipeline.
It's a great idea. Yeah. Well, it's such an important, if you think about how overwhelmingly agricultural medieval Europe was, how agricultural Europe still is in large part. It makes great sense, you know, and also, of course, as you point out so regularly, like so well, we read everything we need into our animals as well, right? Like the way we talk about our relationship with dogs, the way we talk about that, really, you know, how we use horses, these are all a demonstration of what we're thinking about ourselves, which is of course an obsession for medievals as it is for modern people. So it's a great idea. Let's go through the main body of the book a bit. So you start at the first chapter, we're talking about encyclopedists as well. And so, like, for just for instance, what's the conception of the ass we get from, say, Isidore of Seville?
Yeah, Isidore is, again, well, he's relying on the classical authors. I mean, he basically just paraphrases people like Pliny the Elder and Aristotle, who, you know, wrote the first encyclopedias and wrote about every animal that they knew about. So Isidore sort of copies what they've said, and he says it's a slow, sluggish beast, but it's easily captured and domesticated. So obviously, you know, they were easy to train, and therefore, you know, they were the ideal animal to help them on the farm as a pack horse and so on. And then that reputation is sort of cemented in stone at that point. Because the later medieval encyclopedists like Albert the Great, Thomas of Canterbury, Bartholomew the Englishman, they're basically, again, paraphrasing Isidore, who's paraphrasing the classical authors. And so this reputation of the ass as this slow, stubborn beast is one that's just perpetuated.
Right. And both of these things are, you know, so it's hardworking. Good. I mean, slow and stubborn, but also patient and useful. I mean, you see this, it's not, I hesitate to say a complex picture of the ass, but it's definitely, you know, multifaceted and overall a very useful beast.
Certainly. I mean, it starts, like I said, it starts as this slow, stubborn beast. Isidore does say that it's very hardworking, but as we get into the later Middle Ages, you know, the 1100s, 1200s, what people are doing then is they're putting a religious slant on it, and they're seeing that Christ, in the Bible, Christ has a strong association with the donkey. So how do they bring that into the picture when other people are saying, oh, it's just this stupid beast, you know? So you're right, it has this eclectic reputation, where on the one hand, it's quite negative, but on the other hand, if we're going to associate it with Christ, then we're going to emphasise the fact that it's a patient beast, that it's a humble beast, and that it's worthy of respect in a way.
Sure, right. Which you really get into in The Religious Ass. And I absolutely love this chapter. On one level, I will admit, I'm just a 14-year-old boy, right? So I just giggled while I was saying The Religious Ass over and over again. It's shameful. But more to the point, my scholar brain really enjoyed this source material and the analysis, and it was so much fun to think about. You know, the ass is one of God's creations and thus worthy of some respect, and is used, like the whole rest of the creation, though, didactically, right? What can we learn from the ass? And a whole lot of medieval ink is spilled to explain Christ riding an unbroken ass. Just so much discussion of this. This is so important. What does this signify? Why is Christ on an ass?
Yeah, well, it depends who you are as to what it signifies. It depends who you're writing for, who your audience is. In one respect, it's signifying the Jewish population. In another respect, it's signifying the humble Christian who submits to Christ readily, and so on. So, yeah, it's a fascinating take on why does Christ deliberately ask for an unbroken ass to ride into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday? And these medieval scholars were writing about it and coming up with a few different reasons why. But going back to what you said at the beginning about having a chuckle about the chapters, I have to say I had great fun coming up with them and even deciding, were we going to call the book Introducing the Medieval Ass or were we going to call it Introducing the Medieval Donkey? You know, we had to go with
ass, clearly. Yeah, no question. Definitely. The medieval ass is the way to go. Yeah. So good. I am heartened by that response to know that I'm not alone. Yeah. And I think it's, I mean, that in itself, the amount that we can just like ass is fundamentally an amusing word. And because of the way, like of these connotations, right, that the ass is a little bit slow, not the smartest, but there's also that element too. Like, you know, every now and then I find myself calling my partner an ass. And what I mean is I'll say, stop being such a jackass. And what I mean is he's being a trickster. He's being a problem. He's causing me, you know, he's out of control. He's acting, you know, like perhaps like the devil, who the ass can also reflect.
Yes. And again, in the bestiaries, the Book of Beasts that were very popular in the 1100s or 1200s, the ass was quite often associated with the devil, particularly because of its loud braying. And again, that goes back to the encyclopedias. The encyclopedists talked about how the wild ass brays. It's very loud. It's very ugly. And so later medieval writers who had this religious background were associated that with the devil, you know, because it happens that the ass brays at night, apparently. and so, you know, that's the devil looking out for sinners, and it's a time when Christians should be very careful and so on. And again, it goes back to a didactic text. It's teaching the reader, mainly a Christian reader, how to behave, how to avoid temptation, how, you know, avoid the loud braying ass at night because that's the devil and he'll lead you into temptation. It's trying to keep the Christian on the true path and guide them towards salvation.
Which is a good part of the bestiaries do this, right? And these listeners, these are wonderful sources, and there are actually a few of them that are available online. And so, you know, just go Google medieval bestiary and you will not be sorry. You will probably go down a rabbit hole, but you will enjoy it. But they're very didactic. And so we learn so much about ourselves. But so we go from this kind of, you know, there's also then the debate of philosophers. And I want to focus on, I mean, let's pick William of Ockham and his use of the ass. That seems a good example, right? And he uses the ass to discuss free will of all things. Can you explain that?
I have to say that writing the chapter on the scholastic ass was the most challenging chapter that I wrote because I'm not a philosopher. But Ockham was interesting. I think what you find is that these scholars who have like a philosophical approach were talking about the leading academics of their time. And I think there were lots of egos in play. So Ockham had his rivals. And what these scholastics would do would be to, they would give public talks on what they believed, you know, on their work, so to speak, and people would be able to ask questions and challenge them. And he had a rival, John Buridan. They were contemporaries, but from what I can gather, they came from two different schools of thought and they didn't get on very well. And yes, they so William of Ockham does have this theory on free will, but so does John Buridan. And the listeners are probably more familiar with the theory of Buridan's ass, which the theory goes that if an ass is placed between two bales of hay, equal distance, it won't know which one to choose because they're equally as good. And so in that case, it will choose neither and it will starve and die. And this was part of the free will. It didn't have the free will, or it exercised free will but couldn't make a choice. And that was Buridan's theory. Mm-hmm. Actually, he never said that. And if he did, it's not written down anywhere today. But it's been ascribed to him. But regardless. let's just say that's his theory. William of Ockham disagreed. And... Mm-hmm. So he comes out with this very sort of scathing comment and calls his opponent an ass. So he's sort of, I think what I found fascinating was it just goes back to ego. I'm William of Ockham, and you should be listening to me, and I have all the right things to say, and don't be listening to that Buridan over there because he's just an ass, and his theory on free will, well, it's just nonsense. I think that was the thing that I got from it, and I tried to simplify it as much as I could in the chapter so that people could appreciate that side of things.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Well, because it works on both levels, right? I mean, if you were a contemporary of these two, it works as their argument. They're discussing the ass, and they're discussing, you know, what's the point of free will if you don't have the intellect to use it? These are important questions. These are like central to the human existence, but also, you know, that they're also just petty little men who are being rude to each other. And it makes perfect sense that they use the ass for this. You know, also Abelard, Peter Abelard is similarly uses the ass, and he's quite famously a bit of an ass himself, right?
Correct.
So this works as well. You know, so I think this is an interesting chapter, and you do a very good job with it. You know, medieval philosophy is not necessarily my bag either, but it becomes very clear. And I think that the ass is a wonderful place to get at medieval philosophy, actually, because unless you really want to debate in your head the merits of free will on the human existence in the medieval era, just knowing it helps you understand that what's at stake. It's a good idea. And then your final chapter, The Ass in Literature, you examine these fabliaux, which clearly are very close to your heart, and you've written about them before. And listeners, they're so popular. It is very hard to overestimate the import of these. I mean, because we have them in written form, right? But they're an oral tradition, yes? Mm-hmm. Like, how is the medieval audience interacting with this material?
That's a big question. I don't have the answer. So from my perspective, yes, they are an oral performance. I mean, I think that they were written down so that people who were the performers had the workbook, if you like, to remind them of what the stories were. But they're all in rhyme. They've got a nice rhythm to them when they're said, which would make it easy to remember them, I think, mm-hmm. once you're performing them. Mm-hmm. But there's not been a lot of scholarship on the actual performance of the Fablio, and we don't know for sure. But, of course, they were performed. They were dictated, read out. And I'm sure that when the jongleurs and the minstrels and whoever were reciting them, that there was probably ad-libbing. And there was probably also hand movements, gestures, and things like that. So to add to the humour. But even just reading them as they are, there are some 1970s translations into English which really sit in the 1970s un-PC world, which I think really get to the heart of what the Fablio were about. So they're slightly more ribald and slightly more risque than some of the more modern translations that are around right now.
Our sensibilities have definitely changed.
You still get the sense of them being, highly entertaining. I can imagine them being performed in a tavern when everybody's had a bit of a drink. I can imagine them being performed in the market square on market day when there's a crowd of people, and so on. In a court, in a royal court, I can imagine them being delivered there for entertainment as well. So they cross the social classes, if you like.
Yeah, and I think that, especially that becomes really clear if you look at some of their predecessors and descendants, right? If you look at Apuleius's Golden Ass, if you look at Boccaccio's Decameron, there's this, it's clear that there are many ways to tell these stories, and they're very familiar themes, right? And there are some themes that come through repeatedly. Let's look at the This Is a Great Place. Talk to me about the Testament of the Ass and what that the secular tale that's very popular. What does that tell us? Well, tell us the story, if you don't mind, a little story sure. time.
So if I remember it now, so the story is that a priest owns an ass. It's been a loyal and faithful ass for 20 years, and it dies. And the priest is very upset. And so he buries the ass in the cemetery. And then the bishop finds out that the ass has been buried in the cemetery. And that's a big no-no. Animals, cemeteries are only for humans. Only humans are going to heaven. Animals are not. Animals are usually sort of left outside the city gates to rot, particularly, well, asses were in particular. So the bishop calls the priest to explain himself. And the priest realizes he's in a bit of bother here. So he says, what happened was this. He said, the ass, when the ass died, it left a will, a last will and testament. And it's left all its money to you, bishop. And the bishop says, oh, thank you very much. I'll take that. That little legacy, if you don't mind. And so the story ends with everyone's happy. The ass remains in the cemetery. The priest is happy because the ass is nearby, and the bishop's happy because he's got some money. So that's the gist of the story. That's the bare bones. If you want to break that down, I mean, right at the very beginning, I said that the ass had served the priest faithfully and loyally. So that's that's in that religious setting of what we expect from from an ass, that, you know, it mirrors Christ, it mirrors the good Christian, in that it serves Christ through the work it's done for the priest. The other thing is the way the bishop accepts the money. So there's the prevailing thought or rumours in this particular period of time was that many bishops were accused of being greedy, of taking money for themselves and not for the good of the Christian flock. And to me, this is a prime example. This is an author having a bit of a dig, a bit of a, mm-hmm. you know, casting an aspersion on a greedy bishop. I think the humour comes from the fact that the ass is buried in consecrated ground. Mm-hmm. I mean, people have, when I've presented this at academic conferences, people have said, do you think it's all about the emotional connection between man and animal? And I think it is, but only up to a point, because the Fabio mm-hmm. are not about the touchy-feely, oh, poor priest, he's upset that his donkey's died. There's a little bit of that, but I think the author's using that as a stepping stone to then shock you.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Into, yeah. Oh, he did what? He put the donkey right. in the cemetery? Right. You know, everybody would have known that was a big no-no.
Sure, and that hits on a literary tradition as well, right, where animals acting in ways they're not supposed to. And then, of course, priestly avarice, like the greed of the church, is a theme that we're going to see a lot. So, that makes sense. But then just the absolute, like, laugh out loud of a priest burying his donkey where he's supposed to be putting consecrated, you know, like, this is for souls, in consecrated ground. It is funny, and it shocks, you know, it still works. And then, but I want to talk about one more story from that, which is the fable of the ass and the lapdog, which is another kind of theme. There's a lot of thematic elements that you're going to see throughout the period and well into the Renaissance. All right, so can you tell us this story?
Sure. I mean, for anyone who doesn't know, the fable of the ass and the lapdog is that, is it a farmer? I'm not sure. But anyway, a man has... it must be a farmer. Anyway, the man has a lapdog, and he lavishes a lot of attention on it. And the donkey works very hard for the man, but he doesn't get the same sort of adulation. And so the donkey's quite jealous. And then one day he decides, well, I'm going to sit on the farmer's knee, and he can pat me and stroke me like he does the lapdog. But of course, I mean, you can imagine the image of a donkey trying to sit on somebody's knee. You know, it's totally ridiculous.
It's funny on its face. Yeah.
And the donkey earns a sound beating for for doing this. And the moral of the story is that it's basically know your place, know where you stand in society. You know, an ass is always an ass, and it's never going to be a lapdog. And that story was that fable that would have been very well known was taken and modified by a Spanish author, a priest, who wrote a book of the Book of Good Love, I think it's called. And in it, he changes, the farmer becomes a woman, a mistress, a well-to-do mm-hmm. woman, and she has the little lapdog, and the ass is very jealous of all the attention. It's exactly the same format. But the language in this story takes on a very sexual aspect. So in medieval society, small furry animals were often a symbol for the woman's, like, sexual or the woman's sex. I don't know what I'm allowed to say.
Anything you want. Like, go right ahead and say genitals. Let's go with that.
Yeah,
like,
any thoughts on nether regions, you know. Her,
ooh, I like nether private, regions.
area. So the way the author's built this story, you can see that, you know, when the lady strokes the dog while it's sat on her lap, there's this strong sexual connotation, mm-hmm. as well as the fact that it sits beneath, like, a fur rug on her lap mm-hmm. as well. And so, there's language about the dog licks and kisses her. But again, it's not just, you know, mm-hmm. oh, my face. There's a whole sexual connotation to this. So, of course, when the ass decides he's going to sit on the mistress's knee, he, like the dog, raises himself up on his back legs, and of course he's exposing his phallus, you know, his manhood. And again, he earns a good beating. But the whole thing is just, it's reworked to, I think, show the sexuality of women, mm-hmm. And to show it as a dangerous thing in a way. Mm-hmm. The ass, again, gets a beating. It's men that come to do the beating of the ass. They've got like phallus-shaped clubs. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the image in the book, which is actually from the ass and the lapdog fable, from the traditional fable, mm-hmm. Again, there's still sexual connotations in that, mm-hmm. as well as the reworking.
That's lovely. I want to spend some more time with the fable of the ass and the lapdog as well now, because it's so ribald, particularly the later Spanish code. It's so sexual. It's so over the top. I mean, hilariously so. And I'm imagining a performance of that, what that must look like, right? It's a funny story. But then it's also this cautionary tale about female sexuality. And I think these two, like the way this, the ass and the lapdog, these things, the testament of the ass, like I think that there's a lot in the ass in literature that really shows us the complexity of the ass and the importance of the ass in medieval society, which is really enjoyable. This is such a tidy book. You get in, you explore it. I understand. And you're like, and there's the ass. And it's really nicely put together. I really enjoyed the book. I highly recommend it, of course. And it feels like you've reached a point with the ass. So are you working on the ass some more? What's next?
So I think one of the things I've done since, because the book is only 30,000 words. So, it's a short book. As you said, mm-hmm. I had to get in there, tell the story, and then move on to the next story. And there is so much to say about mm-hmm. the ass. But because of all the research that I did, all the sources that I found, the things that didn't make the book, and also more modern experiences of the ass, I've actually started a blog. And it's... you know, bloggingdonkeys.com, a very simple title. And I haven't actually used it, I don't think, very many medieval sources. I've probably gone for the more modern things at the moment. But it's like the gift that keeps on giving, because I was going to maintain the blog for a year, see how many blog posts I had. But we're 18 months in, and I can just keep going. I don't think there's any end. To this, there's so much to say about the ass in our world, in the centuries after the medieval society and the medieval world itself. So
there's this thing is with us, right? This animal is so important and it's so intertwined. And still, you know, when I was reading about the braying donkey, I was thinking about, you know, I had students in Morocco in this little oasis village, and I was trying desperately to sleep, and there was a horrible donkey, and I'm like, I get that. He is the devil. I was thinking that, you know, 2 a.m. when there was a donkey braying next to my head. I was like, good God, man. They're so loud, and they do kind of sound, demonic, you know, in the middle of the night in the dark, dark desert. What the hell is this thing? There's so much more to do here. I'm so glad you're not done. And I mean, you could have been. You tell your story. You could be done. But I'm glad to see that there's more donkey coming our way. Well done. Excellent. I have taken enough of your time. Thank you so much for meeting with me at the end of your day. I'm about to start mine here in Amsterdam. So thanks very much for meeting with me, and I'm looking forward to reading more about donkeys in the future.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Wonderful. Bye.